So when I when the knock came on the door, I swallowed the contents of his canister, thinking, of course, that it was a harmless LSD substance.
Hello, everybody. I'm going to keep this short because the story of Charles Innes is so complicated that if I begin to start describing it, this intro is going to be 20 minutes. If you're interested in listening to the full unedited interview with Charles Innes, you can listen to it on my Patreon at patreon.com/HamiltonMorris. But I think the story is so important that I wanted to make it publicly available, and I think that this version will give you the basic contours of what happened. The full interview is over 2 hours, and it contains dozens of supporting PDF documents that allow you to better understand Charles Innes' story. But this should be sufficient for most people that are curious about the way drugs are portrayed in the media and the story, which had a really important and lasting impact on American perception of drugs. So I hope you enjoy the story. And before we begin, I want to thank this episode's sponsor, Canaclear. It's well known that the cannabis plant contains a wide variety of fascinating phytochemicals. It's one of the most studied plants in the world. And so I'm always amazed when researchers discover new compounds in cannabis. What was especially amazing is that in 2019, a group of researchers in Italy found a new cannabinoid called THCP that is structurally very similar to THC, but it has a 7-carbon chain instead of a 5-carbon chain. The extension of that chain gives THCP much greater potency. So at the CB1 receptor, which is responsible for the stoning effects of THC, THCP binds with 33 times higher affinity, making it the strongest known phytocannabinoid. I thought that this would remain an obscure scientific curiosity, and I was amazed to find that within 3 years of its discovery, techniques had been developed to industrially produce THCP from hemp. I saw that Canaclear.com was selling it. I independently ordered a sample, analyzed it via NMR, and found that the material was bona fide. So if you are interested in THCP, Delta 8 THC, HHC, or any other unusual phytocannabinoids, go to Canaclear.com. All of their materials are third-party tested for quality and compliance, and if you use the code Hamilton, you will get 15% off any purchases. Thank you, Canaclear. But I wanted to maybe start at the beginning, if you want to talk about your family, where you grew up, your background. I know that you have a really interesting family.
My background, I guess my mother was an acrobatic dancer who was in the 1930s and 40s, art dancing was part of vaudeville and burlesque. And my father was an elected official in Massachusetts. He was in the Senate, and they got married in 1941. And I've got one brother and one sister who passed away, who both made nice careers, and I miss them both. I got married in 1968.
And so I've seen some people write about this contrast between your upbringing with the idea that you came from a sort of Boston Brahmin type background and then became a hippie. What drew you to the counterculture?
I see. Well, a solid upbringing certainly left many things to be discovered. And when I got to Johns Hopkins as a freshman at age 17, youngest in my class, I think, the city looked like a place of fun and adventure. It was an opening experience. The people on campus said, "Don't leave campus. The only good thing about Baltimore is Hopkins, and everything else is a problem." And of course, we are right now the murder capital and the venereal disease capital of the United States in several categories.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yes. Syphilis was most prolific here, and human papillomavirus really got its start in 1988 here in Baltimore City. And fortunately, we've got 12 wonderful hospitals in the Baltimore area, including three world-class hospitals. So a lot of good medical science is done here. The anti-war protests brought many of us students into STEM. It's called Students for a Democratic Society, SDS. And so at Hopkins, I was recruited and gladly joined with my classmates in demonstrating for civil rights. And later on, against the war in Vietnam, my friends and I did demonstrate against segregation here in Baltimore City, which was rife in the 60s. Hippies and beatniks and persons using drugs were not much in evidence till 1966 and 67 and the late 60s. New York, the Lower East Side of New York, and Greenwich Village were places where common use of marijuana and hashish and LSD were born before, really, the San Francisco events, which ended up being the Summer of Love in 1967. And we fantasized that if somebody had sprinkled LSD on President Lyndon Johnson's cornflakes in the morning and he began to trip, that he would, in the afternoon, he would cancel the war in Vietnam and call it off.
That's the hope.
That was our hope, but of course it was not to happen. Anyway.
So you're part of all of that. You're a student at Johns Hopkins. You start as a freshman in the late 60s. What year was it?
I started in 63. Got to be on academic probation in the next couple of years. Ended up dropping out in January of 67 to go west and visit San Francisco and the Summer of Love. I got to say, it was a magical event, really. And the draw, I don't know how else to describe the magnetism. There was always something to smoke and maybe somebody giving away LSD. If you went to the Fillmore and paid, somebody would say, "You want a trip?" You say, "Yes." Open your mouth, and they flick a pill in there. And I moved into another commune, this time a good one, with not based on drugs, but based on good nutrition and agriculture and farming. And I got to stay at a farm north of San Francisco, which was focused around gardening and tripping and spiritual learning. We attended a meditation every Monday night class. And it was a wonderful event because persons from all over the world had really come to San Francisco because of this magical process that was happening.
Sounds wonderful.
Thank you.
Wow. And you mentioned that you also had some experience with the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic. How did that come about?
Well, some of us were having sex with people we just met, and we were passing around gonorrhea. And hepatitis type A, which the kissing disease. And I caught both of them, of course. And gonorrhea was cured with a shot of penicillin in the butt with a 16-gauge needle. Do you know how big that is?
I do, yeah.
It's a way, way big needle, and it goes when it goes into your butt. So, you know, it's like you got to steel yourself for it. Anyway, they don't do that anymore, but... Anyway, so God bless David Smith. I hope he's still alive. He would be in his 80s.
He's alive.
Thank you. Have you spoken with him?
I have, yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's one of my saints in my pantheon. He operated a clinic, realizing that all these people had come from all over the United States, mostly to San Francisco. to meet one another, and he offered free medical care, and most of us didn't have any money, and there were people suffering from bad trips because of pre-existing mental conditions and or bad drugs, and of course from venereal disease, STDs were rife. And also, you'd have to be medicated if you got hepatitis A. You can get sick for a certain period of time.
Right.
And I met a biker girl and got my green wings.
Tell me what that is.
I'm not going to.
Green wings.
Yeah, well, anyway.
Well, now I'm curious.
Well,
can you hint?
The red, you get your red wings. Red wings are... Well, of course, as a biker, of course, you wear patches to tell who you are. You wear colors, and on your colors, which are your denim jackets, what you wear all the time, you wear the various symbols that show what you do and who you are, and whether you're a one percenter or whether you're, if you smoke marijuana, you put a marijuana leaf on your arm, and let's see, cunnilingus, during menstruation gives you red wings.
Okay, all right. And this is a badge that you wear.
Pardon me. Well, I mean, it's gross, and that was part of what bikers did, is they did gross things, and it was an awakening for middle class kids to go meet bikers who were didn't bathe, and who were pugilistic, and the Hell's Angels sort of turned bad right in our presence, right there during the... They started out somewhat as idealistic folks who had high standards. They professed high standards. You can't be a Hell's Angel unless you're a man of some integrity and truthfulness. We also meditated out on Mount Tamalpais in the nude, and getting sunlight all over us and losing our shame. It wasn't an orgy, it was getting some sunlight. It was a liberating experience. And I had a storage in Baltimore, and I came back to go get my things. And the first thought I had upon entering Baltimore, I was sighted back then, was I driving up Charles Street, as I saw three police cars at midnight on the same street, looking in either direction. You know, I had only seen one police car in 3 weeks of driving around in the San Francisco streets, a calm, peaceful, nice city. In Baltimore, a place where crime and poor government and corrupt politicians have been in charge for a long time, not to mention lots of drugs. If drugs were to be bought on the block, they would generally be adulterated, and they would generally be of poor quality. As, for instance, a fellow that I knew who wanted to buy marijuana from me would take a marijuana cost only $20 an ounce back then. It was plentiful, and it wasn't super powerful, but it was the real thing, and he would mix it with grass or male plants, and it was not pleasant to smoke, and it didn't taste good, and it gave you a headache. And so it was a different world. The criminal underworld was has ruled Baltimore in some ways, because a couple of mayors back in those times had sold the streets basically to organized crime from all over the United States, and they had all taken establishments on the block.
Yeah, and so this takes us to 1970 in Baltimore, something like that?
I was an obtuse fellow in some ways in relation to my relationship with some women that I had dated, and I think, and a certain number of, and of course, if you smoke marijuana in a critical place where it's highly illegal, people can tell on you. And so one day, the boyfriend of an ex-girlfriend came to me by telephone with a proposition that he had some hashish to sell. And this is hard to tell you. I'm going to preface by saying that his name was George, and he wrote me a note, which I got in the mail, which said he had a grocer with all the ham, and the bazaar was about to begin, and I could, if I had some money, I could buy some hashish. And he turned out to be working for the state police, Maryland State Police. And the offer was that he was going to sell, his dealer friend from New York was going to sell me 10 pounds of hashish for $600 per pound, which was too low. The price should have been 800 or so. And there were several phone calls. Eventually he said, well, we want to know if you're not a cop. You have to go get some cocaine and bring the cocaine to trade for the marijuana, for the hashish. So we know that you're not a police. So I didn't have anything like that kind of money. I think I had $1,800 total in my savings total from being in the automobile repair business. And so I went and got a partner, a friend named Bobby, and he had a couple thousand dollars and liked hashish. He was a hash head. And so the two of us went out to a motel with this 16 grams of rock cocaine, which is powdered cocaine that is snorted in the nose. There's nothing like crack. It is, crack is, I understand, more powerful. I've never tried it, and I'm not going to. But anyway, I had obtained some rock cocaine, and when we got to the motel room, the two guys in the motel had 10 pounds of 10 bags of hashish, 10 pounds of hashish sitting on a bureau with a weighing scale, but it was powdered green hashish. It wasn't anything I wanted. It was low grade, and it would burn hot, and it wasn't anything that would be pleasant for me anyway. And they drew guns and said, you're under arrest, and took the cocaine and went out in the parking lot, arrested my friend in his car, and they charged us with possession of cocaine, and they made us lie down on the bed with handcuffs, and I was in shock. I was in total shock. I had never suspected any of this kind of thing. Apparently the room next to the motel room where he had been had a bunch of police in there, state police detectives, a whole room full of them, and they'd all, when this event happened with us being arrested, they all cascaded into the room around us like out of nowhere. And so I was thinking, the two of us, Bobby and I, are sitting in the back seat of this police, state police trooper's cruiser, and I said, if I'd been a federal agent, you guys would be under arrest. So there was an almost audible click going on somewhere in the front seat. I shouldn't probably, I may not have said, supposed to have said that, but anyway.
What was the audible click?
Well, they realized that this was entrapment, apparently, and deconstructing what happened next, they hadn't asked permission to take the drugs out of their evidence locker. They hadn't cleared it with their prosecutor and didn't know what they were doing. And they realized that basically the definition of entrapment is if the police create the criminal activity rather than the member of the public, then it's not law enforcement. It's make work, which is not doing the public any good. And eventually the prosecutor agreed with me and Bobby and Nal Process. But meanwhile, this was a setback for these particular police. And I didn't realize what kind of pressures and politics were going on at the time in relation to the police and law enforcement. This grand jury apparently had been going on. And three of the four police officers that were involved in corruption. And anyway, they had to make up an arrest if they couldn't get an arrest. It looks like the grand jury had found that they were taking money. And they were letting the bad guys off, and they had to go make up arrests or find hippies or people who were not doing any serious criminal activity and upgrade them into more serious activities. And so 4 months after this, we bailed out, and I had to sell all my furniture. I didn't have any money. They confiscated all my money, and they confiscated Bobby's money and his car. He had a midnight blue Chevrolet Corvette Stingray, and he cried. He was crying. It would have been funny, except that, of course, anyway, that was going to happen one way or the other. But anyway, so one of these club owners from the block kept calling me up and saying, "Charlie, sell me some marijuana. I need some marijuana for my bar." He owned two clubs, the Dollhouse and the Pussycat, on the block. And he had apparently, I don't know his full situation, but it turns out he was under indictment at the time. And I didn't have any marijuana. I was so scared, I just said, "Nope, I'm not doing any of this. I'm not gonna, the state has got a monopoly on whatever this is, and I'm not going to be in the marijuana business at all." And I divested it all. It's all gone. And Mindy and I kept enough for our personal, I think I owned two joints. And she had a couple of mescaline tablets for us to take. I eventually proposed to her, by the way. And she said yes. But anyway, the club owner, his name was Bobby too. Bobby called me up. He said, "I've got a present for you. it's parsley flakes with a psychedelic on it." I said, "What is it?" He said, "It's an LSD-like substance." I said, "It's not angel dust, is it?" He said, no, it's like LSD, it's a legal form of LSD. So he sent a lady over that I both of us knew with this canister full of unknown substance, and I think that was the 13th of May, and the next day they sent a raiding party to my house. Five police narcotics agents to search my house and recover this. Apparently, they knew that they had propositioned the Bobby, the club owner, to do this in order to get out of his drug arrest, kingpin drug arrest. And when the knock came on the door, I swallowed the contents of this canister, thinking, of course, that it was a harmless LSD substance.
So just to get into your thought process, so you didn't know that you were being set up. So why did you consume the contents of this film canister?
I thought there was a possibility that it was illegal, And I foresaw the possibility there would have to be an analytic process. He said it was a non-illegal form of LSD. And that, you know, I shouldn't have trusted him, I guess. And he sent it over by a courier, which was an ex-girlfriend named Susan. And he turned her out and turned her into a nightclub worker who made a lot of money, a beautiful young Jewish woman with blue-green eyes and gorgeous blonde hair. And her brother turned out to be a DEA agent and everything. So I didn't know about all the mechanics of it, but this five-man raiding team got unleashed upon me with great violence. I let the police officers in after I swallowed the canister, and somebody said he swallowed the shit. And a big detective, about that wide, pumped a fist into my belly, knocked me off my feet onto the ground, and several police officers proceeded to kick me in the head and the torso for a whole minute. I can remember trying to get into a fetal position to protect myself, and it didn't stop, so I finally got up and to take whatever they were going to give me, and they stood around and said, and they stepped back a foot, and they said, "You were under arrest," and I put up my hands for the handcuffs, but I started going into a daze. From the whatever was in the canister, which the chemist has come forward 40 years later and told me what was in it, a miracle.
Really?
Yes. In 2015, I was in a store called Strawberry Fields in Hamden, and a man walked up to me and he said, "I know who you are. You're Charlie Innes, aren't you?" I said, "Yes." He said, "I made the angel dust that you ate." And I said, "Really?" I asked him his name, and I'm not going to repeat his name, because he was very brave and conscientious to come and tell me this. And I said, "You work for Bobby?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Bobby works for the government, doesn't he?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Thank you." And anyway, he said he had made the cocktail, he called it a cocktail for me, that apparently Bobby had paid him. Bobby had lots of money. And Bobby was engaged in all kinds of criminal activity. What I knew about him in those 2 years of 70 or 71, I said he had these two clubs, and he was doing counterfeit money and credit card fraud, and pretty soon his family was involved, his father and his uncle and his wife. Everybody in the family was involved and got busted, and they all went to jail, but he didn't. And I made lots of friends. I made a few friends on the block who had some ideals and all. One of them, late Roland Benu, rest in peace, was a nice man. He had decided, his own life had been changed through tripping, and he felt that he liked hippies he one day he told me by telephone, he said, "Charlie, you know, Bobby works for the government." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, a lot of people don't know that. But if he thinks you're going to tell on him, he'll hit you quick." So some serious mobsters, they're murderers. At any rate, I don't want to lose this narrative too much here. So,
You're on the ground, the cops are kicking you.
Yeah, I stand up and I get handcuffed, and then I get thrown into a paddy wagon, and I get given the treatment, which is a rough ride. Now, it's been litigated, but I had been, well, they picked me up by two police by each armpit and led me into the paddy wagon, which is a steel box 8 feet long by 7 feet wide with two steel benches that go fore and aft, and a little oval window that goes into the driver's compartment in front, and they slam the door, and I'm in handcuffs, and the driver accelerates into the corner and then hits the steering wheel real hard, so hard that I rise up from my seat on one side to an almost standing position and get slammed against the opposite wall of the wagon. Bam! And knocked out. Lights out. Last thing I remember is my face and head hitting the steel wall. And so I'm taken to the local lockup. We have 9 districts, and I was taken to Northeastern lockup of Baltimore City. And beginning to pass out, going into a kind of a deep dream. And but I'm beaten now. I'm pretty well beaten up. And apparently the mugshot shows bruises all over me. They hold me up so that they can take the picture of me. And then a few minutes later, a few hours later, don't know which, they take me to a hospital called Union Memorial Hospital. And the lead detective has not found any drugs in my house, because there weren't any. Well, there were 2 joints between a newspaper that he didn't find. But that's it. Well, I'm admitting it. So I had a stack of old newspapers in the back. And since I don't smoke now, I don't now. At any rate, he'd taken all the medicines out of my medicine chest and tested them, and none of them were positive. So he took me to the hospital, and he asked the doctor what did the doctor to pump my stomach. Doctors complied. And he says, give me the report and the contents. He wants the contents of my stomach. So some of the doctors can hardly speak English there. It's an okay hospital, but staffed by some doctors who are called preceptors, who are on probation from other countries, and they don't understand the American Constitution and the rights that you and I enjoy, to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures and cruel and unusual punishments, like having a tube thrown down your stuffed down your throat and your stomach pumped out by. So at any rate, the doctors complied, and a local laboratory, a medical laboratory, not a forensic lab, found that an LSD-like substance had been found in my stomach. But it was all gone. This was 5 hours after I'd swallowed the canister, and there wasn't anything left in my stomach. I had absorbed all of it into my body. So the stomach pump process is called lavage, and I got, so when they had sedated me in order to do the stomach lavage, if they're gonna force a tube down your throat, they have to give you an anesthetic, general or local. And I woke up out of the anesthetic and I couldn't see. My eyes were out of focus. Everything was in bright colors. And I couldn't figure out why I was in the hospital or anything. And I found a tube going into my arm, followed the tube up to a bottle, pulled the bottle up close to my eye and read saline solution 10% normal. I think, why am I in a hospital? And there's a police officer seated next to me in the ICU. And so the doctor comes in and he said, what did you take? I said, I'm not sure. Pretty soon my eyesight started to come back, but I was out of focus. And brilliant colors. And I could still see, of course, but I was a prisoner. So I thought, these guys are trying to kill me. And I made a phone call to see if I could get my girlfriend or a bondsman to bail me out. They charged me with possession of marijuana pipe. They found a pipe. And so I bailed out, but I was tripping. And I'd been thrown into a psychotic state by the stomach pump. Well, I spent 4 days in a psychotic state, tripping, and still so high for the whole time. I had ataxia at some point or another, one of the symptoms. This is a nightmare drug, fenciclidine, in the size of the dose that I had apparently consumed. It causes many kinds of disorder, organ dysphoria, and it's psychotomimetic. It definitely causes a toxic psychosis, and didn't know what it was, of course. So Mindy had gone to the Kentucky to watch the Derby, and she came back. I called her and proposed to her on the phone. She said, yes, we're getting married. And at some point I arrived over her apartment about 3 days later. I had, and she realized that she saw the bruises all over me. I started to tell her what had happened to me. And she went and found a psychologist over at Johns Hopkins to help me, Dr. Wilson Schaffer, whom I'd known, who's he'd been my advisor at some point when I was an undergraduate earlier. She went out to meet with him, and I didn't know where she was. I walked out on her back porch, and I had no clothes on and didn't know it. Eventually, a couple of police officers came and took me into the apartment and arrested me for disorderly conduct. And I don't know why, they wouldn't give me my clothes back. So they wrapped me in a blanket and put me into a paddy wagon on Bolton Street. And they took me to Central Lockup. As they say, there were 9 districts. Central was one of them. And the shift commander wouldn't accept a patient who was obviously ill. And so they sent me to a second hospital, Mercy Hospital, to get examined. And their reports, and it's in your packet, Hamilton, along with Dr. Smith's conclusions after reading their emergency room clinical note. The doctor in the emergency room diagnosed me with psychoneurosis and recommended admission, that I should be admitted for observation because I was ill. And Mindy pleaded with them to keep me in the hospital. And she had come with me, she'd taken a cab over. The police didn't give her a ride. And she pled with the doctor to put me in the hospital, but they didn't have a psychiatrist at Mercy Hospital. And the police were impatient or interested in doing more exciting things than guarding a prisoner in a hospital bed. I mean, I don't really know the rationale by which they would refuse medical attention to somebody. I had told them about the previous arrest 4 days earlier. So they took me back to the jail cell, dressed this time only in a hospital robe. And when I got to the Central Lockup, they had a huge guy there. The Reader's Digest refers to him as a burly jailer, but he was every bit of 6'2 or so, 200-300 pounds, 250-300 pounds, grabbed me and hurled me to the ground. Boom, and I bounced off the concrete. I don't know why, you know, to this day, other than pure sadism, that the love of violence, I have no idea, maybe softening me up to do rape later or something. No concept of what, you know, people who've got a lifetime of being guardians over prisoners, I guess, say, some of them can develop aberrations. These people were not normal. And they put me in a cell, a very dirty jail cell, and with no clothes. And it was cold in there. Mindy had brought my clothes. They put them on the floor opposite the cell and out of my reach. So I begged for water. I missed the evening meal because I'd been away in the getting an evaluation, so I didn't have any food or any water, and I became hypoglycemic, and my eyesight began to disappear. I drank out of the toilet with my hands, cupping water, finally, but it wasn't enough to make me, to hydrate me, and eventually, I felt a veil in front of my eyes, and I reached with my four fingers and tried to pull apart the veil and damaged my eyes. And that didn't make me see anymore, although I wanted to. I couldn't understand why my eyesight was deteriorating. And my eyes then started to bleed. And the jailers eventually found me. They weren't talking to me until at that point. They then threw me on the ground again violently, although I had not done anything violent to arouse them. I don't know why they would do that, but and put a straitjacket on me and sent me to a third hospital, which then got an ophthalmic surgeon to help work on my eyes, to repair my eye globes. And he put the globes back together, but the retinas weren't working. He managed to repair the damage to my cornea, but the retinas had been pretty much burned out by the this overdose of PCP. It's just a perfect storm happened to me at that time, and the people at Maryland General were quite kindly, and I'm still friends with an 84-year-old nurse who took care of me 50 years ago there in that hospital, Nancy Witzel, and a wonderful, big-hearted Christian woman, Edenrit, who has been a guide to me in some important ways. Edenrit, they kept me in Maryland General for 5 days. While I was recovering, they wouldn't let me have any real visits with my friends who had gathered outside of my hospital room, a lot of them. The police had gotten a hold of one of the psychiatrists in the hospital and decided to sequester me so that I couldn't talk to the press, because the local newspapers had gotten a hold of the fact that a prisoner had become blind while in custody. And the inferences, of course, were that police brutality had caused the blindness. And the reporters wanted to know. One of them is still alive. You can talk to him, David Etlin, a retired Sun Paper blotter reporter. At any rate, so they sequestered me in the hospital for a period of time and then certified me to go into a mental hospital for examination, having portrayed me as a violent psychopath and dangerous. One psychiatrist, and when I get to the Springfield State Hospital, they rather quickly realized that I was not dangerous and that I was going to recover and that I was going to be dealing with the difficult problem of rehabilitating myself from, I could now see nothing, totally blind. So I got a hold of an alphabet card from the National Federation of the Blind and I taught myself the Braille alphabet. I stayed there 2.5 weeks. I taught myself the Braille alphabet, got a hold of a Braille book, started to read it. They lent me a talking book machine and I started to read a book. And I made plans on how to live the rest of my life without eyesight. I had to find a way of moving about, so with some help, I found a bush and a stick that I could make a cane out of on the grounds and made a walking stick out of that. And I returned to my home in Baltimore City there now. And a dear friend came and stayed with me, Audrey, with her son, and at the same house that where I'd been beaten up and arrested. And anyway, so my landlord didn't want any more to do with me, and I ended up moving, and I made plans on trying to return to Johns Hopkins as a blind student. And a year later, that's what I did. Senator Lapidus heard of my problem through his brother. His brother was a friend of mine, Joe Lapidus, and I was granted a senatorial scholarship, a full scholarship to go to Johns Hopkins. And I returned in 1972, Hamilton.
That's great, wow. I mean, it's inspiring that you were able to make the best of the situation because it's a truly horrific thing to have happened.
Thank you, I hope it doesn't happen to anybody else.
But the story is even more complicated than I realized. So just to take a step back, I didn't realize that there were two separate arrests that occurred in quick succession. So you have the first arrest where you have the overdose, then you are released, and then there's this episode where you're found naked in somebody's yard. So what was happening? This was a prolonged psychosis from the original consumption of the contents of that canister?
What's the last question? I'm sorry.
So as I understand, I may be confusing the timeline slightly, but it's my understanding that you consume the PCP in this canister.
Yes.
They beat you.
5 days. 5 days between consumption of the canister and arrest for in a psychotic state. And my Mindy lived on the second floor, and I did not go into the yard or into the street. I was on her back porch, and I had thought she'd gone out the back exit in order to go wherever she was going. Didn't know where she had gone, and police climbed the fire escape to her apartment and took me inside, and I was arrested for disorderly conduct. The charge was dropped the next day, along with the marijuana charges from 5 days earlier. While I was in hospital recovering from being blind, the second arrest was I was in a disoriented psychotic state. The police officers were not particularly sympathetic or understanding and did not get me medical care. And eventually this turned into a lawsuit. While I was in hospital, an attorney who had read these stories and used his analytic intelligence to figure out that I must have been brutalized suggested a lawsuit, and it ended up being two suits, one a medical malpractice suit against two hospitals, and the other a suit against the police department for A, brutality, and B, practicing medicine without a license. The police delivered a blind man to my emergency room out of custody who had been in the hospital 6 hours earlier. What's going on here? And furthermore, he just got out of Union Memorial 5 days earlier. Why didn't they pick this up? And so on. And that's what his affidavit says. I'll share it with you.
And what did your girlfriend say about your state at this time after the release? I mean, what was happening to you psychologically? You were still under the influence of this massive PCP overdose, it sounds like.
Well, she was horrified and scared for me. She realized that I'd been beaten and that I was under the influence of some kind of drug. That I wasn't responding in a normal way. So she'd summoned Dr. Schaffer. Dr. Schaffer didn't get in touch with me until after I became blind. It was too late. But meanwhile, she was devastated. She was the last friendly face that I saw before I lost my eyesight. I could still see her standing in back of the paddy wagon. A very forlorn expression on her face. She had tried her best to keep me from being sent back to the mausoleum, Central District lockup, where I became blind. So she didn't know how we were going to have a married life together, and was quite disoriented. She visited me in hospital, of course, every day, but they'd only give her 5 minutes at Maryland General when she came in. I had restricted visits. Maybe the theory was somebody was going to bring me drugs. I don't know what the theory was, but I think the theory was rendition, that basically the press wanted to know, why did this prisoner become blind? And so the police response was, he did it to himself. And the chief detective, of course, had to really, he wasn't a detective, he was just an officer, had to concoct some kind of a story that Mr. Innes was a drug abuser who had deliberately and was self-destructive, I was personologically self-destructive, which was not and is not the case. I think I've lived a constructive life and performed lots of public service in my life, much less than I might have if I had not had the slanders put on me by them police officers who were blowing a lot of smoke.
And this story is tragic on so many different levels. The fact that the medical profession didn't save you, the police not only did they not help you, they created all of this. But one of the things that I find most disturbing about your story is the way the press responded to it. The way they took somebody who was a victim and they basically made it seem as if they were responsible for their own fate.
Well, thank you. Somebody with an almost satanic cleverness managed to create a story that grew legs. The detective who arranged the planting of the drugs and who talked to the press had to accuse me of self-destructive behavior. And he shared that with a national newspaper called the National Observer, which was a tabloid published in Washington, D.C. The article was titled Charlie's Awful Trip. And it put words in my mouth, and it had that I was claiming to be a deity, and had me pointing and proclaiming and preaching and shouting slogans, and all of this was pretty much manufactured out of thin air. The were trying to manufacture an image of a counterculture figure who had, as you said, a rich kid gone astray, and so on and so on. And then anyway, that story got picked up by the Boston Globe and redone, worse, and they had me as a prophet. And let's see, I'm not a prophet of anything. And the Reader's Digest, and of course, Reader's Digest republished the National Observer story without calling me, without verifying any of this stuff with me. So April 1972, probably 1,000 words or 1,100 words article, which is concluded, nobody wants to go where Charlie Innes has been. And somewhere behind those lifeless eyes. It was quite dramatic, and it had a kind of a cartoon taken from a photograph of me looking like a bedraggled, deluded hippie. But anyway, regardless of my college degree, I was unable to get a job after that. Most people, anybody who read any of that kind of stuff, decided, well, this is a nut job, and he's probably on drugs. And to this very day, there are people who still associate me with drug abuse or drug use, and I swear I haven't smoked a joint since 1985, and I'm okay with it. I'm on a natural, natural trip with using prayer, meditation, and fasting get me to all of the altered states of consciousness that I need in order to stay happy. Can we ohm? Oh.